From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
We'll hit speeds of up to 145 kilometres an hour. I wouldn't be doing that on the M50. And, I'll experience six times my own body weight in the corner.
At any stage, Fran, did you think you were going to lose people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely thought at one stage they were gone.
By brutal, they don't mean brutal. They mean it's brutal conditions. It's an Attenburyan brutal as opposed to a Dublinese brutal.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, when your honeymoon becomes a honey month, a miraculous sea rescue on a North Dublin beach, and can anyone find love on Twitter? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's most likely to be swiped right to. Right is yes, isn't it? Let's do a Maria von Trapp on it and start at the very beginning. The newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty show spent a little time on our host's lack of interest in video games, one of the world's biggest industries. Is it a blind spot or something else? We may never know.
Never got into computer games, ever. And even when we do them on the toy show, I'm always a little bit, yeah, they're there. And yeah, I know they're massive. And they're sometimes even bigger than the movie world. I understand. And I know that I probably have a bit of a blind spot to them. I'm not going to lie to you. But in China, they've decided enough is enough. The Chinese government, this isn't an endorsement of the Chinese government, by the way. We know that they have stories to tell, and they don't often tell them particularly in a transparent way. But the Chinese government has banned under 18s from playing online games for more than an hour a day. And that's only between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and bank holiday, and public holidays. The ban will be enforced by online gaming companies that are now required to strictly enforce rules requiring users to register accounts with their real identities in order to play. And this follows shares in their biggest online gaming companies slumping after state media branded their product spiritual opium. Because they're just addicted. Kids are addicted to this stuff. And compare them to electronic drugs. And this reference to opium is charged in China, where European powers like Britain and France hobbled the Qing dynasty in the mid-19th century through heavy imports of the drug, ultimately leading to Hong Kong being given to Britain as a sovereign territory before it was returned in 1997. So the crackdown on the companies was sparked by an article published by a state-run, Economic Information Daily that warned teenagers were addicted to online video games and called for the industry to be curbed. So really, it links right back to the mid-19th century where they got, we're not having that again. So a little resonance in history there. The newspaper appear to criticise Tencent's flagship game, Honor of Kings. And many of you listening this morning going, oh, I love Honor of Kings. They play it all the time at home. I've never heard of it, but it is reported it's sometimes played by students for up to 8 hours a day. Pass me by the computer games, but they're massive. We had a tiny little game at one stage, which I was totally addicted to. And it was a little box, very peculiar machine called Lupin. And it's got nothing to do with Lupin, which is this famous TV show that's on at the moment, but it's called Lupin, and we used to play it for way too many. It was our little box of opium when we were kids, but I never saw it. I've never heard of it before or since.
Coincidentally, the new season of The Late Late Show kicks off this Friday with Ryan going head-to-head with Graham Norton in a Fortnite death match. Kidding, Fortnite doesn't do death matches. Shame. But there's TV to be watched between now and then anyway.
One of the things I really enjoyed watching was a drama called Vigil. Have you heard of this? And I didn't think I was going to enjoy it, largely because it's based in a submarine. And I get a bit claustrophobic even thinking about submarines. I've never been in one. I don't know if I really want to go in one. And then the submarine is obviously under the sea and deep in under the sea. And that freaks me out, that sense of the water all around. And what the... I find it hard to breathe. But it's a good premise. The people who brought us Line of Duty and Bodyguard, they give this premise, which is the guy who wrote The Crown, Tom Edge. What if a crime was committed on board a nuclear submarine, and what if that crime turned out to be a misdirection for something far more sinister? And we're off. Great cast, by the way, including Saran Jones. And it's tense, and there's political intrigue, and there's a big piece today in the Daily Telegraph in the UK about whether or not any of it is based on fact in terms of the chain of command, the submarine itself, the size of the cargo. But anyway, it's called Vigil, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and that's going to get a run out for the next little while, because it's particularly good.
Now, I really hope management and RTE are paying attention to this next story.
Staff, meanwhile, at Nike's corporate headquarters have been given a week off. Why would the bosses of this big corporation give them all a week off? And following the example of the dating app Bumble and LinkedIn, why? Here's the answer. It's because they need to support their mental health ahead of the return to the office in September. This is so progressive and necessary. But they said that until Friday, the US firm Nike will power down to give employees a rest after a tough year. I like that. Take the time to unwind, de-stress, spend time with your loved ones. This is the firm's head of insights, he said in a message. It follows similar moves from Bumble, LinkedIn. A growing number of employees have reported feeling burnt out as the pandemic drags on and many continue to work from home. And yet we have this lovely, I think hopeful news yesterday about our own situation here. Things, doors opening, lights being turned on again, music being performed again, more sports being played again. And it's just looking so good. I'm not sure it's the same in the United States. But it's not just a week off for the team. They say it's an acknowledgement that we can prioritise mental health and still get work done. And that's what one would hope, that one of the lessons, this is the expression we're going to be hearing a lot of, what are the lessons we've learned from the pandemic? And one of them has to be that we need to respect the mental health of employees a lot more, I think, than has been done to date.
Can't argue with that. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks. What? Oh, lousy RTE. Anywho, Ryan caught sight of an interesting wedding trend on the wires this morning.
Honeymoons are now extending because people are saying, well, we've got a smaller wedding, pandemic, smaller wedding, smaller crowd, smaller spending. So let's enjoy ourselves and go on an extended honeymoon. And now it's called the honey month. Now, I like this idea. I think you should definitely go. I'm a fan of treating yourself. Treating yourself every time. Anytime the option says, will I go for the cheap one or the slightly more expensive and tastier one? That one. Will I go for the one that's good for you or the one that tastes nicer? Just, it's not always, but most of the time, treat yourself. Honey month. Definitely, if you can, do it. A month of it, perfect. And if you can survive that, you're in for life.
You say honeymoon, I say honey month. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I think there's a theme developing here. Now it's time to take a Tuberty Show newsings journey from John Thaw all the way to Macca.
They did a couple of polls in classic FM in the UK to find out the most beautiful theme music in British television. And it's been won by, this poll had been topped by Downton Abbey before, Sherlock topped it, but this is the third one they've done. And the winner is the theme music to one of my favourite programmes of all time, because of the car, because of the actor, because of the location, because of the storylines, because of Colin Dexter, John Thaw, the whole thing, and the cleverness of the use of Morse code in the... Inspector Morse. Yes, very, very, very beautiful. And of course, he was a music fan himself, the inspector. And Downton Abbey is also very beautiful. Have you seen the dog, my lord? The dog. The dog is dead. Died of what? I won't mention the dog actually in the end of the day. And my favourite of all time, bar none, and I have this on my Spotify playlist because I love it so much, Brideshead Revisited. Come on, it's gorgeous. Now tell me this, that's Brideshead Revisited, which I think is so beautiful. And it reminded me a little bit there as I was listening to the theme music to Sunday Miscellany, And I'm always wondered, as I listen to Sunday Miscellany, who is that an original classical piece of music, or was it written specifically for the programme? It sounds like it was an original piece, but it's very, very gorgeous. And then listening to the horns on that, I was thinking about the Rick Rubin, Paul McCartney documentary, which is just knockout on Disney Plus, if you haven't seen it. Six parts, half an hour, Rick Rubin, famous music producer, big long beard, no shoes or socks, talking to Paul McCartney, he's chewing gum, you know, talking about Penny Lane. And the two of them and they are at a sound desk in black and white. And it's pure Beatle heaven. But the way he's talking about listening to Penny Lane and the beautiful brass solo on that, and saying that he came from his producer, George Martin, was listening to the music of Bach. And Paul said, oh, yeah, I'd like to know, how did you, like, can we get some of that into our song? And of course, he couldn't read music, so he could only ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da-ta-da to the trumpet player who said, all right, let's have a go. And on it went.
Lots of TV being recommended on the Tuberty Show this morning, just in case your to-watch list isn't long enough. And I can't end today's newsings without including Ryan's debut on the kids' video platform of choice.
TikTok. Now, TikTok. TikTok's a funny one. TikTok is, I think, I'm not sure who, TikTok is a, Instagram, I get. I'm on it. It's fine. I'm mocked for it because it's kind of like, you know, it's very, my girls would tell me, it's like, it's dad. You're like a dad on Instagram. Well, that's fine. TikTok feels like another world altogether. But I'm told by young people I work with, particularly over on the Late Late Show, that, you know, I should give it a go. Should I have a go on TikTok, you know? And I said, well, I don't really know what it is. So they sat me down yesterday and said, it's stuff like this. I said, oh, crikey, lads, I don't know. I think it's for the, I think I should let the youngsters off. And I said, well, that's not even for you. It's for us. It's for the Late Late Show. We're coming back and we'd like to do something. So I said, okay, I'll do something. And right now, as we speak, they're going to send out our first ever Late Late Show TikTok. Like that. So if you look up TikTok now and you look up Late Late, you will see me doing something kind of silly, kind of goofy. And that's what it is. So we'll see how it goes and see if I'm not disowned by my own family as a result. And if that's the case, we'll keep going. But will I do the milk crate challenge? I don't know. We'll keep it fairly handy, I think. So it's not too painful or difficult.
I don't know about you, but I'm all for things that are not too painful or difficult. And that's why I'm bringing the Ryan Tuberty Show Newsings to an end for another day. Well, the last American military flight has left Afghanistan and the Taliban are in charge. So what happens next? David Fox, bureau chief for the AFP news agency, spoke to Claire Byrne this morning. He'd been in Kabul airport earlier and described what he saw.
There's a lot of trashed equipment at the airport. I mean, there's about several dozen, maybe 70 or so, aeroplanes and helicopters, and they've all been demilitarized, as the Americans called it. But I think in civilian terms, you'd call it vandalized and smashed to pieces. The airport has been pretty much trashed on the civilian side, broken windows everywhere, equipment broken. And on the military side, it's everything is inoperable, if you like.
And are there people there still?
No, there's nobody inside the airport apart from Taliban fighters and Taliban elite unit, the Badri 313 unit guards.
And there were reports that several hundred Americans and Afghans who were trying to get into the airport for the very last flights, that they were stopped by the Taliban. What do you know about that?
I don't know about that. I certainly can't confirm that. I do know that in the last couple of days leading up to the last flights, I saw lots of buses getting through, but the only people who were getting through were people who were on official American lists. Anybody else was being turned back by the Taliban and been told, wait for commercial flights and you're welcome to go if you want to.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of who's around there, you say it's only Taliban in that airport now. Everybody else has left.
There's no crowds. There's none of those sort of people clamouring to get on those evacuation flights anymore at all.
And this is what I was saying earlier on about this media clip which emerged from the Taliban saying that people are happy, that the militants have brought peace. This is all part of this PR offensive this time round.
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, there's people are apprehensive, I wouldn't say happy, and people are fearful, you know, definitely not happy. But there is, it's also fair to say, though, that some people are saying, yeah, this is good. The security's improved in the capital. There's no more car theft. There's no more petty crime, that sort of thing. But it's early days, very, very early days.
I saw the BBC reporting earlier that ATMs in the city of Kabul are running out of cash, and that there seem to be photographs of large queues at those ATMs as people try to get their money.
Oh, that's been for days now, actually. The only way you can get money now is in a bank, and you have to queue for a good few hours to get a maximum $200 per person is what they're allowing.
Okay. Would you say that apprehension, widespread apprehension ahead of the Taliban putting their formal government structures in place?
Yes, I think that's very fair to say. People are, you know, they wonder what rules, what regulations are going to be imposed and see how that goes. They've already said no music, for example. They've already said, all schools will be segregated. I mean, all schools largely are segregated, but this is a difference in that you can't have males teaching girls. So a lot of girls will lose out on the opportunity for science education, for example, because there's a shortage of maths teachers and science teachers from women.
David Fox, Bureau Chief for the AFP News Agency, speaking to Claire Byrne from Afghanistan this morning. Claire also spoke to Colin Clark, Director of Policy and Research at the Sufan Group and author of After the Caliphate. And Claire asked him what the Biden administration's plan is for getting the remaining Americans and their allies out of the country.
I mean, given how haphazard the entire withdrawal and evacuation have been, one does wonder what the plan is. We hear any number of platitudes from State Department spokespeople, but I think the administration is in a bit of chaos at the moment, trying to figure out exactly what the plan is going forward. The fact that there have been American citizens left behind, according to reports, tells you that if there is a plan, it wasn't executed properly.
I was reading how the search for a consensus amongst how Americans feel about what has happened. And it seemed certainly 2 weeks ago that Americans, according to polling, were behind this decision to withdraw. Those numbers seem to have come back a bit now. I saw an Ipsos survey saying that around 40% approved of this decision. How is this all going down in America?
Yeah, I think there's, as usual, separation between this polling data and then, I guess, kind of the purview that I have, you know, as someone that studies national security, somebody that's a counterterrorism professional. Most of the people in kind of my world have been against the withdrawal because they're concerned about the implications for the regrowth of al-Qaeda, and issues with the Islamic State Khorasan province. But if you look at, as you mentioned, the kind of general polling, the American public is war weary. It's 20 years of war in Afghanistan with little to show for it. And so many people are sympathetic to the president's desire to withdraw, and I think are consumed with domestic issues, including COVID-19.
Can you tell us more about your fears coming from it, as you said, from your perspective?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Taliban have never broken with al-Qaeda. They've never even pretended to. And now they are back in charge of the country. I don't think it behooves the Taliban to allow Afghanistan to once again devolve into a launching pad for international terrorism. So I think they would actually do everything in their power to prevent al-Qaeda from at least launching attacks against the West. But that presumes they have the capability to do so. The Taliban have been effective insurgents. They're now tasked with governing the country, and I think their bandwidth is going to be stretched. You know, think back to the 9/11 attacks. Al-Qaeda planned those without the Taliban's knowledge. So certainly they could attempt to launch attacks again without having the Taliban know exactly what's going on, while the Taliban still provides that safe haven or sanctuary to al-Qaeda militants.
I noticed you didn't mention ISIS there. Is ISIS a credible force in all of this?
ISIS is more of a spoiler role in all of this, but certainly one that needs to be taken seriously. There was a plot in the spring of 2020 linked to ISIS militants in Afghanistan that stretched all the way to Germany, threatening to attack U.S. and NATO bases in Germany. So ISIS-K's tentacles do extend beyond Afghanistan and beyond the region into Europe, and I think that also is something at the top of everyone's mind. Within Afghanistan itself, there's little concern that ISIS will be able to usurp the Taliban, but they'll certainly be able to make things painful.
Is there any way that the United States could be drawn back into this region?
It's a great question. It's one I've been getting for the past several weeks. I don't think so under this administration. They've really pinned their hopes to getting out and getting out and kind of moving on. So I don't see that scenario. If there is a huge and overwhelming regrowth of terrorist groups in Afghanistan, you're likely to see this managed through what the president's described as over-the-horizon capabilities, drone strikes, potentially a special forces raid, although even that is quite risky. But I don't think, under this administration anyway, that we'd see any scenario that brings U.S. troops back to the country.
Colin Clark, Director of Policy and Research at the Sufan Group and author of After the Caliphate, talking about the situation in Afghanistan with Claire Byrne this morning. Fran from Dublin told Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the miraculous rescue of her children at the beach.
Basically, it was a summer's day and we went down to Rogerstown Beach and the kids were playing.
And Rogerstown is near Rush, scary.
Rush. Yeah. And the kids were playing, having fun, and then within seconds, it's like a current happened and the kids just couldn't get out of it. So my sister-in-law went in first and then my husband went in and there was four kids in the water.
Good.
And then they all got into difficulty, so another man, Sean, went in with his son Alex, which is 14, and then another couple went in, but then they were all in difficulty, and then three other men then kind of formed a human rope and eventually got everybody out.
That sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was very frightening. It happened within seconds.
So at one stage, many people were in difficulty.
There was my husband, my two kids, my sister-in-law, her two kids. And then I think Sean and Alex got into a bit of difficulty at one stage. And then there was eight adults at one stage in the water. And five kids.
So eight and a teenager of eight.
Teenager and four young kids.
13 people.
Yeah.
And were there any lifeguards or?
No lifeguards, no rings to throw into the water. There was absolutely nothing. As my 8-year-old son said, it was like something was dragging at his legs and pulling them underneath the water.
Fran, I'm talking to Fran Kinsler. Fran, was there any was there any signs up saying?
No signs at all to say dangerous area or anything like that.
And when when they all got back out of the water safely?
Yeah.
What did you do? Did you pack up and leave or?
Oh, no, we kind of stayed around for a while and we were talking to Emma and Sean and her child, Alex, and the two other kids.
Okay, because
and then I was thanking the three lads. I never got their name, and there was another couple as well. We kind of all just stood around in shock for a while.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, it was very,
and
very
hard. At any stage, Fran, did you think you were going to lose people?
Oh, yeah, I definitely thought at one stage they were gone. I couldn't even look. My sister-in-law, she went under. My husband, it's like as if the current kind of ripped him around the pier. But then eventually I seen his head pop up. But yeah, it was a very close call at one stage.
And you're saying literally you were looking at people being swept out to sea and they're waving or whatever, trying to get help.
Yeah, so my nephew was trying to save my son and then my daughter was trying to save my nephew. So it's like the kids were trying to all help each other.
And you don't know who those three men were who formed the chain?
I don't, to be honest with you, no. I couldn't. I tried to find them through Facebook and everything.
What day of the week was it, Fran?
It was a Sunday, I think.
Sunday, okay.
Saturday or a Sunday.
And what, about 5 or 6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And Emma Nixon was caught up in the same horrific incident.
Yeah.
Emma, tell us what your memory of it.
Yeah, no, we were on the Rogerstown Beach there and... So basically, I could see the four little kids out playing, and as they were pottering around, the current was going out further and further. And what happens there, Joe, is the current so strong that it takes the sand away from underneath. So the kids went into a dip.
Okay.
Because we went down the following day, and it's a really big dip. Like, so everybody that ran in then, because we noticed the kids were in difficulty, everybody that ran in went off that ledge and into the dip. So So, and the current was so strong, it was just, you know, so I told my husband, quick run, and then he ran in, and he went off that ledge as well, trying to push everyone. And next of all, I look, and then there's my 14-year-old son is in there. So all of a sudden now, I'm going, oh my God, this is three families now. And within seconds, it got really bad. And I was like, oh my God, I can't get in here, because if I get in, I'm only going to be someone else that needs to be saved. So I just turned and screamed for help. So there was a lovely guy that was there with his wife. He ran in first. And then two lads that were up in the grass area ran in. And then another girl, Roisin, she came over and ran in. And within minutes, everybody was taking everyone out. But
thank God. And was any, Emma, was any of your group, were any of them good swimmers?
Well, my husband, like, you see what happened there, Joe, is like my own father warned me. He always said, Emma, don't be careful down there. Rogerstown is known that the current is so strong. So I'd say the best of swimmers would have struggled in that situation. It was, yeah. And I think when you go down, you would have to see that dip, you know, that, and again, like, really, if there was a sign there, because a lot of people run and jump off that pier, and if there was a sign there, it would have been great. But there is a buoy, but it's up at the sailing club, so it wouldn't have been near enough. Like, nobody knew on the beach what was happening. Everyone just assumed, oh, look at them, they're all having fun. Like, it got out of control. I've never witnessed anything like that in my life. It was really, really worrying. And I remember looking at Alex's face, my son, and he was holding one of, I don't know if it was one of Fran's kids or her sister-in-law, and I knew by his face, he was like, ma'am, I'm struggling here, you know, and yeah, it was horrendous.
Emma Nixon, and before Emma, Fran Kinsella describing an incredible sea rescue at Rogerstown Estuary in North County Dublin to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line. Brendan Doyle has a dream, a very specific dream. He told Ryan Tuberty about it this morning.
The big dream is to get the Irish flag to Beijing Winter Olympic Games, February coming in 2022.
In what discipline?
In skeleton.
I think I've seen it. It feels like there's a man or a woman in a bucket and they're flung down a hill. I mean, describe me. Give me the science of this or the sporting endeavour of this. What are we expecting? What is it?
So essentially, skeleton is one of three ice sliding sports. It's a winter sport. Mm-hmm. It's Formula One on ice. It's human powered adrenaline fueled racing. Now, if any of your listeners have watched Cool Runnings, the story of the Jamaican bobsled team at the 1988 Calgary Winter Olympic Games, you have an idea of the kind of track the races will go down. It's an ice track made up of banked corners, so the corners come up. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever gone down a water slide, it's that same feeling that when it curves, it kind of picks you up in the air. But the difference is, I don't have this lovely big sled around me to keep me nice and safe when I hit a wall. I go down on what essentially looks like a tea tray. Now, I'll push the sled off the top of the track, and I'll jump down on my stomach, and I'll lie, and I'll go down the track head first. We'll hit speeds of up to 145 kilometres an hour. I wouldn't be doing that in the M50. And, you know, I'll experience six times my own body weight in the corner. So it's a lot of speed. It's a lot of force. But it's just an absolute incredible spectacle.
And has Ireland form in this regard?
Ireland, we've punched well above our weight. In 2002, Clifton Rothersley finished fourth in the Park City Winter Olympic Games. And, you know, I've taken up the flame, as they say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is my fifth year in the sport. So, you know, I've just come back from Park City, where there was three races there during COVID times. So it was a lot of work just to get out there. You know, and I've podiumed. I got two silvers and a bronze. You know, and I've been to two world championships. I've been to European championships. You know, Ireland are as competitive as ever in the sport. So, you know, it's exciting times.
You joined the Gardaí in what year?
It would have been 2008.
Okay. And you weren't long in it when it all went a little awry.
No, it was essentially about a year into the job. You know, it's a dangerous job. It's very dynamic, and you know, I responded to one of those incidents where it went quite wrong, and you know, I was attacked at knife point, and you know, physically there are some scars left, and you know, my hands, basically, you know, the nerves are taken out of my thumb, and my small finger is currently just stuck at 90 degrees. The ligaments have frozen. So I do have some of the physical scars, but it was the mental scars from that incident that kind of took my life on this crazy kind of path.
You initially, after that attack, you've described this lovely idea that you slept, and it was, you know, you were just kind of, it was all fine until that changed, like on a coin.
Yeah, essentially the night that it happened, I remember coming home and kind of reassuring the folks that the sky hasn't fallen, everything's fine, you know, I got unlucky, but I was lucky, and I went to bed that night and it was fine. But, you know, the next night we've all had those kind of nightmares where it follows you a little bit and it takes you just a few minutes to get back to sleep, where I was having night terrors where they were just very, very vivid imagery from the assault, and you know, I'd wake up trying to stop the bleeding in my hand and things like that. And you know, eventually I found it very difficult to go to sleep. I was afraid of these kind of night terrors, so I would do what I could to fill the nights, because sleep was just not an option.
Like what?
You know, and I started off you know, just driving around Dublin to fill a couple of hours and then come back. But you know, I suffered with this for a number of years, and you know, it basically, when it got to the worst of it, I would drive to Cork and back to fill the nights, or I'd drive up to Sligo and come back just to fill the nights, because sleep was just escaping me. And it was like the insomnia was one of the hardest things for me to deal with, because I wasn't able to take that moment just to decompress and reset. It was just constant, just days were kind of molding into each other.
Did that lead to paranoia?
It led to a very kind of heavy bit of depression, and it led to kind of anxiety, and I was constantly like in this kind of highly charged nervous energy. I wouldn't say paranoia per se, but it'd be more very much I wasn't able to deal with kind of life on a day-to-day basis.
What about panic attacks?
Panic attacks, actually, so when I kind of been an athlete my whole life, I said to myself, get back into work, you know, throw the leg over the horse, you know, it was a once off, you'll be fine. But you know, I was on duty, and it was a very, very mundane, normal, everyday call, and I just remember you know, my protective stab vest feeling like a lead weight, and the collar around my neck felt like it was tightening, and I'm an asthmatic, so I thought it was an asthma attack, so I reached for my inhaler, and it just didn't help whatsoever. Now, luckily enough, I went back to my sergeant and I explained what was going on. He told me, you know, this is what's happening. I knew what a panic attack was, but when I was going through it, I couldn't identify what it was, which was strange to me. But I had to take some more time off, because it was just, again, it was getting so physical. I genuinely thought it was an asthma attack. So,
how do you get out of that? How do you move on or change your life?
It was funny, you know. It basically, I had to get really bad before I got well. And when I had a really bad moment, I went to a friend and I just told them how bad it was. And I did so just to keep myself accountable. I didn't have this big romantic conversation to have. I just said, this is what happened, and I just want to tell you just so I can keep on the straight and narrow. And he just told me to do the one thing that I've been doing my whole life, which I stopped, was go back to the gym. And you know, do something that, you know, makes you happy. So I got back into the gym, and it was very, very light stuff, once or twice a week, you know, in and out, not a lot of work. But eventually, you know, because I was around the people that I used to be around in athletics, they said, hey, come back and try to race again. So that's exactly what I did. I came back and I had a goal to race. And it was funny, I was at the senior national track and field in Santry, where the then president of the Irish Bobsled Federation just happened to have been there to watch one of his athletes, and he said I should come back and give it a try.
And that changed everything, really, didn't it? It's amazing that the restorative power of sport.
Oh, I'm look, it's massive, and one thing is the physical activity, be it a walk or getting into the gym, it just puts you in such a different mind frame. Mm-hmm. And obviously, sometimes it just tires you out so you can get that nice sleep that you need. But, you know, that getting back to sport was pivotal because I was surrounded by positive people, you know, doing something, and it just gave me that little bit of extra energy that I needed to kind of get over the hump.
So there is an Irish Bobsled Association.
There is indeed, yeah. We're small, but we're growing.
Okay. Had you seen something as a child on TV? Or, I mean, it just seems like a slightly unusual choice to kind of say, that's what I want. Where had you encountered it? You know what I mean? What exposure had you to the sport?
Yeah, well, I didn't get into it through my secondary school, for sure. It was basically, I took up track. I started playing football as a young lad, but when I got into secondary school, my teacher got me into track and field. And it was when I was out at Morton Stadium, there was a bobsled team at the time training, and they were like, hey, you know, you're good over 30 metres. Do you want to give this sport a go? And, you know, I gave it a shot and I absolutely loved it. So that was back in 2003, but the problem was there wasn't enough money to keep it going. So I basically essentially did 2 or 3 weeks, caught the bug, and then held it for the rest of my life. And here I am.
And again. Here you are. So can I ask what age you are, Brendan?
I'm 35.
35.
Actually, I just turned 36 on the 27th of August.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. And 36. So, and the aim is to get to Beijing 22. Is that the...
Yeah,
Winter Olympics
in Beijing. So that actually starts. So we're in such a unique situation right now where we're seeing our team in Tokyo just finishing up, and then we're seeing the Paralympians currently competing. Mm. And then, you know, my season essentially starts the end of September. Competitions will kick off in November, and I am basically graded on my 8 best races to qualify. So it's basically November, December, and then the cutoff point is January 16th.
How are your savings looking?
They're looking rough, and I'll tell you why. The last five years of this, I have put my money where my mouth is, and I've invested in myself. I'm a true believer that if you can't invest in yourself, you can't expect someone else to. And I've put everything I've owned into this. And I'm now at the stage where the performances and the trajectory I'm on is fantastic, but the finances just are not there to do it. So I'm really facing a situation that if I don't find sponsorship, if I don't find help, I don't have a season, I can't go.
How much do you need?
So this season, with Olympic year, there's basically, it's a little bit more expensive than most other years. We've hired a good coach, and there's a lot of travel involved. So this season's bill is going to be sitting around 50,000.
All right. So you need some international corporation or national corporation turn around and say, God, I love this guy's story. We'd love to sponsor him. And then they'd get their name on your gear and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Brendan Doyle talking to Ryan Tuberty about his dream of representing Ireland at the Winter Olympics next year. A review is apparently underway into whether masks should be compulsory in schools for pupils under 13 years of age. John Boyle, General Secretary of the INTO, speaking to Claire Byrne about masks in primary schools this morning, told her that his union welcomed the review.
We continue weekly to ask the Department of Education and Public Health for evidence of the ongoing reviews that they promise are happening. But I think this particular review that's been mentioned at the moment will be maybe more detailed than what happened before. At the moment, there is an age restriction that children under the age of 12 ought not wear them in education settings. But it's interesting that some of those children would actually be in a primary school. And the Department of Education's advice to primary is that 12-year-olds in secondary ought to wear them, but not in the primary school, unless, of course, their parents wish for them to wear them. And we got that clarified last week that where parents want children to wear them, that's acceptable.
What feedback are you getting from members on this? Because I would imagine, having three under 12s, that it would be tricky enough to have them wear the mask for the entire school day.
Yeah, in actual fact, the last report that was published in March said that with respect to mask requirement in primary and special school settings, it's not always easy to identify the children who may be vulnerable to the potential harms of using the face mask. So there are a lot of issues around that, and that's why I suppose our members are concerned that that schools would remain safe. And if public health then makes recommendations, we'll be happy to cooperate with the recommendations as we always have done. so long as it's based on up-to-date public health advice. And we do hear in other jurisdictions where some of the older children, maybe in third, fourth, fifth and sixth class, wear them, and we do see them wearing face masks maybe out and about in shopping centres and so on. But we're not advocating for them, but we're very, very happy to see that it's been reviewed, because it's a year now since there was a detailed review, and we do have the largest classes in Europe. We don't have the children vaccinated yet anyway. And, of course, we have a lot of concern that the case numbers have been really, really high in the last month.
So whatever HICWA says, you'll go with it?
Oh, absolutely. And when HICWA make recommendations, and the Department of Education generally, to be fair to them, they do take the recommendations on board. The only one I'm concerned about, actually, that hasn't been acted on as of yet, is that there was a detailed recommendation made in on the 1st of April, I think, that there would be antigen testing pilot schemes in school settings. They haven't happened yet in primary or secondary or special schools. They only happened in childcare and third level. So we're anxious to see those pilots run, and based on the outcome of the pilots, then we'll see if there's a case to be made for those.
And I'm sure you raised that with the Department of Education. What response, if any, have you had so far?
We have been raising it, Claire. The response, I suppose, has been that there were difficulties in the month of June with the licensing of the particular test that they intended to use. And then, of course, secondaries had closed at that point, other than leaving cert exams. Primary were due to close. So they have been running pilots. We haven't seen the outcome of the pilots in preschools, or indeed preschools, I think we're very keen to see, because there's not much social distancing in preschools. Okay, they do have much smaller classes than we have in primary, but we'd like to see that outcome maybe before we have the pilots beginning then in the schools, and whatever asks are made of teachers and families in regards to antigen testing, I'm sure we'll be able to cooperate with it too. But, you know, it's challenging because, as I say, large classes, and if there was to be an antigen test done every single day, this takes time, and we don't want it to interfere with teaching and learning either.
So you're meeting the department tomorrow. I'm sure you'll be raising that issue again.
Yeah, we will, and a number of other issues. Maybe they're coming to light in the last number of days, because we're hearing already that since schools, some of the schools opened last week, that there have been some outbreaks in schools. And, you know, we want to make sure that the public health supports that were there for schools are augmented this year. We had difficulties in certain parts of the country at certain times. We found, for example, you've often heard, like Kenny, Limerick, different areas where there was a spike in infection rates, and when principal teachers were trying to get through to public health or vice versa, there wasn't enough support in that particular area at that particular time, whilst in another part of the country, you know, thankfully it might have been a bit quieter. So we're just hoping that they continue to review the supports that are in place for schools. We're also looking to the budget, because, you know, COVID hopefully will be a thing of the past, but we still have the largest classes in Europe. We still have our middle management teams stripped out of schools. And the big issue in the programmes in the last week has been the lack of funding, where primary school children are only worth €1 per day from government to fund the schools, whereas secondary schools get double that. So we have a lot of ongoing work now as the school year begins, Claire.
That's John Boyle, General Secretary of the Irish National Teachers Organisation, outlining the challenges facing the primary school sector, to Claire Byrne this morning. Jane Willow is looking for love on Twitter. She told Ray Darcy about her quest this afternoon.
I was telling our listeners that you're coming on, and I said you've tried everything else. So will you just go through what else you've tried before we...
Well, I ended my last relationship 3 years ago, and I'm a musician, so I used to be at gigs and meet people that way. So I did that for a while, just a bit of dating, but it didn't really end in anything. And then kind of since COVID, I actually kind of started doing online dating, all the apps, you know, and I just got really kind of tired of it, and I love Twitter, and it has done amazing things for me. So I thought, well, let's try it on Twitter.
What amazing things has Twitter done for you?
Just last week I was opening for Lisa Hannigan in Limerick, or the week before, I think it was, and I needed a place to crash, and I tweeted it, and there was a girl that I used to play Scrabble with, who was like, yeah, let's do it, you know, and I met her through Twitter and we played Scrabble and then I stayed on her couch. So like,
and you got chatting with her. She's also from Holland.
And yeah.
Coincidentally, she met her partner on Twitter. Is that correct?
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
Right. Did she give you any advice?
Well, she said she'd keep an eye out for a nice guy for me.
Right, okay.
Her boyfriend is actually, she was like, what's your type? And her boyfriend is ginger. So I was like, just about your boyfriend. You know?
And she said, get out of my house immediately.
I know, it's okay.
Yeah, I'd say you won't be getting an invite back there, Jane. I'm all joking aside, as they say down the country. Right. So I was saying as well, you were on First Dates.
And, yeah, and I was,
that
yeah.
was last April, was it? Or last this year or last year?
I think it was filmed in December. And then
this year, April 2021, was, yeah. yes. Yeah. And you had a date with Killian from Mayo, who was a drummer and a model.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah. He was very nice, but not really my type. You
yes.
know, if you,
which
you
brings
know, the
us
Leonard Cohen vibe.
You or, want a Leonard Cohen vibe. Okay. And what is a Leonard Cohen vibe?
Just the kind of a little bit rugged, right. a little bit rough, but very beautiful.
Okay.
like I don't know, just a beautiful soul, I suppose.
A beautiful soul. So you tweeted, I'd love to go on a date with a cute guy aged 30 to 40 in Dublin. I love art, music and nature. My type of guy is bearded / rugged looking with ginger hair, Leonard Cohen vibes. There it is. Twitter, work your magic. I'm done with dating apps. And you threw it out there into the Twitter sphere. So
yeah, I did.
When did you do it? Over the weekend. So what day did you do it?
I did it on Sunday, yeah.
Right, well, yeah. Well, how's that going for you?
I don't know, like, I spoke to the BBC this morning, so I think we have a good PR campaign going here. It's great, like, I wish I got this attention from my music, to be honest. But
well, we'll play a bit of your music in a moment. That's that wasn't a condition of you coming on. We just we heard it and we liked it, so we will play it. Let's find out a little bit more about you. So you're a musician. You're originally from Holland. How long have you been in Ireland?
10 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you're dropping some of your THs there, which is always good to hear. and you it's 3 years since you were in a relationship. You, as well as being a musician, what else do you do?
I have to kind of work a part-time job, but I really love it. I mind three kids, so
right,
wonderful. And I'm currently, like, my friends are keeping an eye on the kids for me right. while I'm on the phone here.
And you love children?
Yeah, of yes. course, yeah.
And you would like to have your own?
You know, the housing situation is a bit terrible, but if I my dream is to be a foster parent.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
because these, I suppose these are important, aren't they, when you're getting into a relationship?
Exactly. Yeah. Some people think I can be a bit too honest or blunt about things, but then if you want things in life, you just have to make them happen, you know, and like, every, you know, like when it comes to music, every gig I've gotten is just me asking.
Yes.
Like being a bit bold and just being like, hey, do you know, like I recorded an album that's coming out in November and I asked Joe Chibi, who's the head of the RDE Concert Orchestra, to play on it, like to do string arrangements on it. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll do it.
Joe's a lovely guy.
And like,
yeah.
I thought he was going to say no, like out of, you know, and he said yes, you know, so like I just keep asking.
That's Jane Willow, who's depending on Twitter to find her a date. Talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Fingers crossed, I guess. Historian and regular Today with Clare Byrne contributor Diarmaid Ferreter has a new book out, Between Two Hells, The Irish Civil War. And he joined Clare this morning to talk about it.
The really interesting resource that you've used here is the Military Service Pensions Collective Archive. Will you tell us a little bit about that and how it informed your work?
Well, this began in the 1920s when there was quite a noble effort, I think, to try and deal with the consequences of the revolutionary decade for those who had been affected, those who'd been bereaved, those who had lost livelihoods and those who had suffered traumas of all kinds. It does end up, for many, a very disappointing process. Most of those who applied for pensions were not successful. The bar was set very high in relation to who would qualify. There's a lot of rowing about what constitutes active service during that period, and that's difficult for both the men and the women veterans of that period. But it led ultimately to a voluminous archive of over 300,000 files, which have been being released in batches in recent years. And it really gives us a whole new layer to understanding the nature of the conflict, but also its long reach, the fracturing that occurred as a result of it. Mm-hmm. And many of these files cover the whole lifespan of the applicants. And whether they were successful or not, we still have all of their applications and all the details in
that. And if they were successful in many cases, the amount of money they got was derisory.
Oh, it was. I mean, the vast majority of successful applicants are awarded pensions at the lower grade. They're graded from A to E. Women are confined to D and E on the grounds that they were considered an auxiliary force, women in common a man. So that becomes problematic also, because what constitutes active service for women is contested all of the time. And I was interested in contrasting those who did very well out of the pensions process, some of who forged very successful careers in politics and business, and those who were left struggling. And I think this is the value of that archive. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. I want us to try and reset the margins of our framework of interpretation. What did it mean to those on the ground who had lived through it, who had fought through it? What was their Civil War experience, but also their post-Civil War life? And you really do get an extraordinary archive, which is not just about military endeavour. There's medical history, there's housing history, there's social history, and there is a very intimate despair often on display from those who are really, really disappointed. We often think, Claire, of key moments in the Civil War and well-known atrocities or events. Take Ballyseedy, for example, in Kerry, or the Knocknagoshal tragedy. And what I became interested in was what happened to the families of those afterwards. There was obviously a huge attempt to recruit new National Army troops after the Civil War breaks out, and then you have the IRA rank and file fighting on the other side. What became of those families who were left to deal with the aftermath, left to deal with the fracturing, and left to deal with often the loss of a breadwinner as well?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you can be transported from rural Kerry to a tenement in Dublin's inner city, because some of the soldiers who were fighting there were from Dublin's inner city, and you begin to see their social circumstances, because the people who were compiling information for those assessing these applications, they had to go and look at the living conditions and make an assessment of their means. And we get all of that marvellous detail.
I want to talk to you about the women, because I just found it interesting, because you rarely hear the stories of the women and the aftermath of the war for them. Nora Martin was a woman who helped women who were applying, having been in Cumann na mBan, applying for their pensions. And she writes about one woman who she was helping. The woman was Carol. What was her?
Ellen Carroll.
Ellen Carroll. From the very fact of being members of that militant organisation, they were the butt of the jeers and insults of a large section of the community. They risked their jobs, their homes, their lives. This bunch of women whose claims written by themselves appear so unpretentious. Injustice to them. One woman at least should be on the advisory board. So there was no female representation deciding who gets what. Lawyers and civil servants, no matter how sympathetic, can never visualise the feelings of these women during the period 1920 to 24. Can you tell us more about what she was talking about there, what she's getting at?
What a marvellous dressing down that was. Nora Martin was quite a remarkable woman, had a leading position in Cumann na mBan in Cork, and she's infuriated at the lack of appreciation of what these women had gone through. A lot of this book is about trauma. Much of the trauma is internalised, and here you get somebody trying to articulate a sense of why that trauma existed and the contemptuous attitudes to many of those women. She's talking about Ellen Carroll, who was over in Shepherd's Bush during the Blitz, during World War II, working in a sorting office for the British Post Office. She's impoverished. Her nerves are shot, as she puts it herself in her own correspondence with Nora. And she can't even afford to go back to Dublin for a medical assessment.
Well, she's terrified, isn't she? She'll lose her job.
And she said, terrified.
I've been hungry before, so I'm not going to take that risk.
And she is also very conscious that, you know, some of the best years of her life were given over to this. She endured soakings. An awful lot are carrying the after effects of those physical experiences. There were other women, of course, who were on hunger strike during that period. There are over 500 women who are incarcerated during the Civil War, members of Cumann na mBan. And there's an attempt to strip them of their humanity, of their gender, of their reason. They're often depicted as hysterical, as incorrigible. And you get this extraordinary book in 1924 by P.S. O'Hegarty, who was a pro-treaty Sinn Féiner, called The Victory of Sinn Féin. And he devotes a chapter to the women called The Furies. And he maintained that they were responsible, women were responsible for the bitterness and ferocity of the Civil War, which is a remarkable claim to make. But that kind of correspondence between Nora Martin and the board is a reminder of a process that many regarded as unfair. And there are many examples of women who faced those kind of obstacles, but also are dealing with the wider culture of chauvinism, if not misogyny, during that.
And they're dealing with the trauma of gender-based violence, of gang rape, of having their head shaved in some sort of symbolic gesture, oil and grease being put in the hair in order to make a show of them in their local community. And these are things that we don't hear about.
Yeah, historians are beginning to turn their attention to that. And it's not that sexual assaults and rapes were particularly widespread during the Irish Civil War, and that research is still ongoing. But there have now been uncovered numerous incidents of violence against women, and there is a sexual undertone to a lot of those violence. And then there are rapes and there are assaults. There's a woman in Foxford and Mayo, Margaret Doherty, who in the language of the time is outraged repeatedly by a number of men and never recovers physically or mentally. And, you know, how you deal with that in the climate in which they were living is a very, very troubling dilemma.
And the treatment of them by their communities afterwards.
Well, there's no doubt that a lot of people felt that they had fought for something that was noble, that their efforts had been directed towards a different kind of Ireland. They don't experience that. And that's true for many men as well. A lot of them are asking the kind of questions that were asked by the playwright Sean O'Casey. What was it all for? Should a civil war not be fought for a great cause? And O'Casey suggested we need to be careful of personal idealism. He was writing in the 1950s. Its flame in a few hearts may not give rise to new life and hope for the many, but dwindle into ghastly, futile funeral pyres. And that encapsulated that sense of disillusionment. Sean O'Fallon captured it as well. We were woken up from the mesmerism of the romantic ideal. We now had to deal with reality.
Historian and author Diarmaid Ferriter talking to Claire Byrne about his new book, Between Two Hells, The Irish Civil War, this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. But for me, thank you for listening and good luck.